Listeners will have heard of Donald Trump's recent interview on the coronavirus, in which, holding a colored bar graph, he told Axios's Jonathan Swan that, quote, if you look at death right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories, lower than the world, close quote. In reality, of course, the U.S. has some 4.8 million confirmed cases of coronavirus and 150,000 deaths and rising. Trump said, quote, it's under control as much as you can control it, close quote. In reality, other countries that have reacted differently have had greater success in containing the virus. The interview provided vivid, if unnecessary, evidence of Trump's angry ignorance and soullessness. But what's lost when the conversation stays framed around him, when media see their job as triangulating between Trump and the truth? There's a lot at stake for journalism, but preeminently for the lives and health of the people of this country. Here to bring us an update on coronavirus coverage is Neil DeMoss. He's a freelance journalist, a frequent contributor to Fair.org, and author. His most recent book is The Brooklyn Wars. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Hey, good to be here, Janine.
Well, let's start with your latest piece for Fair.org. You're talking about Melbourne, Australia, which just declared a state of disaster. But the piece is on another level about the United States and about U.S. reporting. What are you trying to convey there?
Yeah, so there was a fair amount of attention in the U.S. and worldwide to the fact that Melbourne, which is the second largest city in Australia, had declared a state of disaster because the virus had come surging back at a level that they hadn't seen since the spring and had reestablished lockdown. Only one person in a household can leave the house to go shopping. Very strict measures. But as I started looking into it more, I realized that Melbourne, even at the high rate of infection that they're seeing now, is still doing much better than the vast majority of the United States. If Victoria, the state in Australia that Melbourne is in, were a U.S. state, it would be about in the top third in terms of containing the virus. And, you know, this is obviously a problem, and it's always difficult for the U.S. media to really pay much attention to anything that doesn't affect the U.S. But when it does pay attention to another country, and the only lesson it takes is, man, sure is tough to be Australian, and not, oh my goodness, Australia is doing all this with even a moderate level of infection, and meanwhile, states like Florida that have multiple times the infection rate are doing very little and can go out and eat at restaurants in many parts of the state. That's the wrong lesson we should be taking.
Well, in terms of comparison or context, we are seeing a focus on different states within the United States. Some of it looks like Schadenfreude, you know, states that said we don't need no stinking quarantine and then saw cases spike. But you think that there might be a distraction or a misdirection in just kind of holding states up against other states, too simplistically?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems is it becomes this matter of scoring the standings, right? Florida's in the lead. No, now California's in the lead. That's really not what it's about. I mean, go back 3-4 months and it was New York and New Jersey that were in the lead. And that's how a pandemic spreads, right? It hits here, it hits there. And it's not so much about who has the most deaths or even who has the most deaths last week. It's about who's doing what to try and prevent the spread and contain the spread and, you know, what's most effective. And I feel like that's what we're really missing in a lot of the coverage. You know, there's an occasional article here or there that will say, what's really effective? What can we do to reopen schools safely? You know, is going back into offices something we should be doing? Is opening restaurants something we should be doing? But that sort of gets lost in the noise of who has the highest death rate? You know, what is this governor or that governor saying today? Which is obviously much easier to report, but is much less informative for people who are having to live through this.
Well, and I think that we can acknowledge that this is uncharted territory. You know, there are a lot of unknowns here, but I think it's fair to demand media address it as such, you know, with appropriate disclaimers and acknowledging different degrees of certainty, and not just, you know, as you're kind of hinting at, not just run it through the story machine as if they already knew how things would turn out, you know, and they can do their standard approach of quoting politicians and comparing states in a kind of horse race way. But it always, in a way, comes back to who gets to speak and who do journalists listen to shape their stories. What are your thoughts about the sourcing in COVID stories?
Obviously, I will freely acknowledge, you know, as a journalist, this is a hard story to cover, right? The facts are changing constantly. It's something that nobody knew anything about until a few months ago. It's not something that you can use your storehouse of past stories to go back and say, oh, okay, well, this is just another step in the story we've been telling for a long time. However, there is one way to make this a lot easier, which is to go to the experts who do know about this, right? And there are epidemiologists and infectious disease experts who have been studying, if not COVID, how epidemics go and how, you know, vaccines work and how social distancing works, and have been studying this for years and decades. And we're seeing a little bit of that, but way, way, way too little. A perfect example was that story back in early July that spread like wildfire about how vaccines might not be effective because it looks like after you get COVID, your antibodies drop off quickly, right? This all started with a story, I think, in the San Francisco Chronicle that was based mostly on one researcher who was not an infectious disease expert. He's a molecular biologist and who was involved in trying to promote the idea that we should be studying treatments rather than vaccines because vaccines, you know, may or may not work, which is a legitimate viewpoint, but it obviously means that he's someone who's going to be more inclined to say, well, we have to pay attention to, you know, well, could vaccines fail?
Right.
And the rest of the epidemiology world, as Fair reported, was not thinking this way. And since then, the last few weeks, it's come out, oh, actually, antibody rates come down, but it still looks like they stay at a high enough level and your immune system is primed to create more, to where vaccines, there's no guarantees, but you know, we should be able to expect them to work as well for COVID as for anything else. So again, so many of these stories, what's safe to reopen, what we should be doing, do masks work, are something that you could easily get some information by just calling around and saying to the experts, what do we know, what don't we know, and what can we tell the public? And, you know, that's the sort of thing that journalists are, again, doing occasionally but not nearly enough and need to be explaining in a way that gets at all the nuances and explains, again, what we should be doing, what we don't know if we should be doing, and what we still need to study. It's not the kind of thing that modern journalism really is expert in, because it's much easier, again, to just go and find one expert saying, yeah, sure is really bad, and then, you know, that's your headline. But that's not what the American public and that's not what American policymakers need at this point.
Well, can I just ask you finally, it seems like a lot of stories seem to have an unspoken assumption that, well, since we're not going to stop the virus, you know, what's the best way to do X, Y, or Z? You know, there's almost a giving up on the idea of true containment, and we seem to be talking about mitigation. I mean, is that really where we should be? Is not the lesson that you have to control the virus in order to restart the economy and go back to schools and all these other things? I'm just not, some of the reporting I find very confusing because it seems to start with the idea that that's just not possible.
Yeah, and one of the things that epidemiologists are saying very clearly is if you do want to reopen schools, far more important than paying attention to how much hand sanitizer there is on hand, right, is make sure there isn't a lot of virus out there that people can be catching, right? That's how it's worked in other countries in Europe, in Asia, where they have started reopening schools, is it's much safer to do it if the virus isn't running wild out in the community. That is a lesson that seems to be really, really hard for everybody to understand, is that when you're talking about containment, when you're talking about trying to get the viral levels down, it's not even just about saving people from getting sick or dying right now. It's about getting us back to a point where we can keep the virus at a very low level so that you can start to do some things and reopen the economy and reopen schools and maybe reopen offices and other indoor things, even though indoors is very dangerous, in small ways, because you've created the context for that. And that's something, again, that I wish that the U.S. media were looking more to other countries and trying to see what's worked there, what can work here. But we're still not quite up to that point.
We've been speaking with journalist Neil DeMoss. You can follow his writing at demoss.net. Thank you so much, Neil DeMoss, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Always a pleasure.